From the land to Grand Teton University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 13th day of March. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Mike Zuzulo is out of the office today, so no update of the analytics from him. However, we'll hear from Mike, along with AgMarket.net's Kurt Kimmel and Matt Bennett and Brian Stark of the Andersons, recorded on the 3rd day of March at the All Day Ag Outlook. This is the corn panel. I checked, and the fundamentals simply have not changed at this point, and they believe that most of what they had to say then really still applies today. It's a great program. If you can stay with us for the whole of the hour today, you'll hear all of it. If not, you'll hear a portion of it. It's up online right now at willag.org. We will talk today, of course, about the weather forecast with Eric Snodgrass at Nutrien Ag Solutions, and I'll have an update of the Ag News for you as well on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Again, Mike Zuzulo from Atchison, Kansas, and GlobalComResearch.com is out of the office for the afternoon, so we won't take up the commodity markets and the trade for this Friday with him. However, we will hear from Mike in this half hour and the next half hour, if you can stay with us for the whole of the hour, during our Commodity Week program. That was recorded the 3rd day of March, but still the fundamentals remain the same. It's a really good 40 minutes. You'll want to stay with us for the whole of the program if you can. Again, that's up online right now at willag.org as well, willag.org. But let's do it this time. Turn our attention to the weather forecast. Eric Snodgrass is here. He's from Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible. Hey, thank you much, Eric, for joining us today. I want to look back to begin with, and then we'll turn our attention to the weather that's coming to the Midwest. But certainly, we just had an enormous storm in the last few days, particularly in the Kankakee in the Indiana and Michigan area. Can you tell me about it, please?
Yeah, you know, it was the first moderate risk issued by the Storm Prediction Center this year. And remember, they have a 6-part scale. This would be 5 out of 6 on their risk scale. And the storm systems that blew up in northwestern Illinois, and then the one rogue supercell that went out through Kankakee and eventually got into Indiana and Michigan, you know, was an absolute beast. I mean, it was a what I call a textbook supercell, huge hook echo, and it was tossing out some large hail. Now, there's been an interesting story with the hail. That storm apparently did set the new state record for hail size. I believe it was just a little bit over 6 inches in diameter. But there was another picture that was floating around that suggested that there was another hailstone that was over 8 inches in diameter, possibly even larger, and could have been a new world record holder. But a lot of strange things happened when that picture came out, because the guy took a picture in his kitchen, and you can see his like freezer was open. And so a lot of us were unsure if it was just a big chunk of ice he had pulled out and put a little mud on, but he didn't keep it. So it's never going to go down the record books. But it was a nasty storm, produced a huge tornado. And we've already had quite a bit of severe weather early this year. So we just are asking questions like, is this going to keep going? And sure enough, as we get into this really windy day today, while all of the snow is flying way to our north, we're going to be watching for more severe weather risk late in the weekend. We're going to be more down toward the mid-south, Ohio Valley, you know, southern Illinois more than here. But still, there's another round of pretty nasty weather coming through.
Yeah, tell me about the snow in the northern part of the Great Lakes area.
Yeah, so there's a lot of snow on the headwaters of the Mississippi. That's good. That means there's going to be water coming down that river system when this snow finally starts to melt. But we're looking at parts of Wisconsin and Minnesota, and then definitely the UP of Michigan picking up between 10 and 35 inches of snow out of the next couple of systems. And oh, by the way, this next system coming through is also going to be bringing snow from Montana into the Dakotas, which is going to hit the headwaters of the Missouri River Basin, which desperately needs it. Because with the wind that just came through us today, yesterday it produced huge fires in Nebraska and South Dakota. And so that whole region is very dry. And it's a reminder that you want to talk about it, one of the Corn Belt states that's just been pounded with drought this winter. You got to think about Nebraska, one of the driest winters on record. The Platte River system, the headwaters have almost no snow on them right now. Same with the Arkansas River too. And for that matter, the Colorado River is at a 10-year low on snowpack.
Next week and then week 2? look like what?
Relatively benign. So we're going to hit a big ridge that builds into the southwestern United States, and that ridge is going to absolutely bake the southwest. I'm talking triple-digit heat in parts of Arizona, getting into Southern California. And you know, you expect that there, but you expect that in June, not in March. Very, very hot. The plains are going to heat back up again. We will rebound in our temperatures, but it's going to go over relatively dry. We think that the pattern is going to turn a bit more active as we get out there toward Easter weekend and Holy Week, the whole time period. But you're going to get a little bit of a reprieve in week two. Although, as I mentioned, there's some really, really cold air coming in early next week, kind of our last big shot of Arctic air.
What do you think about early springtime?
Well, my thought initially was we were going to see some tight early windows. So if you're going to get out there and get going and, you know, let's call it the end of March to the first 15 days of April, I still think that's the case. But there seems to be some growing indicators that once we blow past mid-April, we're going to also see more open windows in terms of getting a crop established. And also, I think, I don't know that we're necessarily going to go back over to any really cold air. We might make a break toward full-on spring warmth after about mid-April. Now, again, that's more than a month from now, but that's at least the way the current setup is shaping up. And that's honestly, that's good news for a lot of folks. But we'll have to wait and see how the patterns evolve by the time we get there, because the big story for this summer is going to be this El Nino, which is expected to be a big one. And we're just questioning, is that going to be favorable for us, or is it going to be something that we're going to be fighting against to get our yield goals?
We'll ask you more about that in the future. However, I would like to look at South America. We don't have to wait and see anymore. They've got a good crop.
Well, the thing about South America is the crop's coming out wet on soybeans, and they planted, or they are still planting, about 20% of the safrinha crop outside of the ideal window to plant the safrinha corn. That means a fifth of the crop is going to be vulnerable to mid-season and late-season drought stress as the monsoon winds down. But in the near term, it's very, very wet. And I think that's also playing a role in what could be a supportive weather story for corn. And some of these beans that are coming out, the quality on them has been, well, it's been reported that it's not as good because of how wet it has been. So I think that's a story we need to follow in South America with respect to weather.
Okay, thanks much. We'll talk with you again soon enough.
All right, sounds good. Thanks, Todd.
Eric Snodgrass is with Nutrien Ag Solutions in Daggerville. Joined us on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report that comes to you from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world, online, on demand, anytime you'd like to hear us. Where? At WILLAG.org. That's willag.org. In today's agricultural news, energy markets remain highly volatile this week, and the political messaging out of Washington is shifting right along with the markets. Since the recent conflict with Iran spiked crude oil and retail gasoline prices, President Trump has pivoted his focus. Now, you might remember just last month during the State of the Union, the president was highlighting national gas averages at $2.30 a gallon. Now with the tanker stranded outside a blocked Strait of Hormuz and the national average pushing $3.60, the president took to social media yesterday to point out the U.S. is the world's largest oil producer, noting the higher crude prices bring a lot of revenue domestically. It's a messaging shift that highlights the current tension between keeping input costs low here at home and flexing American energy muscles on the global stage. We'll stay with energy, but turn to E15. The push for year-round E15 continues to face headwinds in D.C., and Illinois Congresswoman Nikki Budzinski says the ongoing delay is frustrating. The House Ag Committee member tells Brownfield the Congress missed its window to pass the legislation last year, and now the Rural Domestic Energy Council has blown past its own late February deadline. Budzinski says the points of negotiation, which largely revolve around small refinery exemptions or SREs, are already well known, and quite frankly, a task force is not needed. With pump prices climbing rapidly across the country, she argues moving forward on E15 is critical now, both to build base demand for corn growers and to help relieve some of the price pressure for consumers at the pump. And finally, turning to 45Z. Midwestern lawmakers are pressing the administration to make sure farmers are not left behind in the new 45Z tax incentive. Iowa Republican Senator Joni Ernst and Representative Marinette Miller Meeks from Iowa are leading a group of farm state lawmakers in a letter to Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins, and Energy Secretary Chris Wright. They're urging the IRS to ensure the final rules for the 45Z credit fully reward on farm conservation efforts, things like cover crops and precision fertilizer applications. With the USDA still developing that tool to calculate carbon intensity scores for agricultural feedstocks, these lawmakers say it's critical the final rule clearly identifies which practices will qualify for a premium. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report on this Friday afternoon. Our theme music is written, performed, produced, and courtesy of Logan County, Illinois, farmer Tim Gleason. Just one note about Commodity Week, which is coming up on many of these radio stations. And if you can stay with us, you'll hear all of that on our home station today. But up online at willag.org, we're trying out a new theme for Commodity Week today. It, too, is written by my brother, Tim Gleason. I hope you will like it. Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our program today comes from the March 3rd All-Day Ag Outlook, the Corn Panel. I checked with each of them to see if things had really changed in the marketplace as it relates to corn fundamentals. They agreed it had not. Our panelists for the day included Mike Zuzulo, he's at GlobalCommResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas, Matt Bennett from AgMarket.net in Windsor, Illinois, Brian Stark of the Andersons in Mansfield, Illinois, and Kurt Kimmel from Normal, Illinois and AgMarket.net. Now, here's the corn panel from the All-Day Ag Outlook.
So they're going to talk to us about the marketplace, I think. Mike, I'll have you set us up. What is the landscape for corn like today across the planet?
Well, it's just a great time to be here. Thank you, Todd, for having this again this year. It's wonderful to see all of you, too. I would say very briefly that the corn landscape has one big problem, and it's not the wheat for a change. It's the soybeans. For a change, I continue to straddle the supply-demand fundamentals with the policy. And ever since before harvest, when we were talking, I was very vocal about the idea of storing corn over beans. It was better in the bin to have corn because of the supply-demand fundamentals. And the policy has made that completely the opposite when it comes to especially the futures market. But I also feel as though that's going to swing back around or could swing back around. And I'm still very worried about a 2018 style type move in the beans. Very sharp, very quick down move. Maybe this spring, maybe after the crop is planted. But that being something that would create the corn to go down with it in sympathy. And there is a gap in the weekly corn chart at 405 on lead month futures. That would be my downside objective on corn versus lead month futures right now. If people said, how much downside do we have in corn? I'd say the gap at 405 is what I would see as the top end downside at this point. And I'm thinking that it's probably going to be because of the soybeans that we would go down and fill that gap.
Don't let me forget to ask why.
For soybeans later, not now. Not now. I want to save that for just a bit.
Your view of the marketplace for corn, Brian?
Yeah, I think the challenge, obviously, as others have stated here, as we've talked on many topics so far today, is the overabundant supply and the need for a growing demand base to work through some of the production that we've been able to continue to build upon year after year with genetics. And I think we haven't really run into a crop growing season problem. So yet then it becomes, how do we find more demand? You know, the positive outlook is that exports continue to be very, very strong. I think that's the good thing. But when you're starting with such a big carryout, and it's kind of a cyclical piece that kinds of to be self-fulfilling, that when you have low prices, most farmers like to plant corn to out-yield the price problem. So then it becomes this circular effect where if we don't find more demand for an ever-growing production, we never kind of get out of that cycle. So I think right now, there's a lot of things that are influencing. The positives are strong export demand, strong ethanol demand. The feed aspect, I think, on the side of corn is concerning because cattle are at 75-year lows. We know it takes a while to build back the herd. So I think that's the one component of demand that has me concerned if it's too high from a usage standpoint in the balance sheet currently.
Remind me to ask you about beef and whether it is just a luxury item or something different these days because of the small herd size. I want to come back to that too. Kurt Kimmel from agmarket.net.
I want to just follow up on Greg's point earlier here on the bean panel. There's so many world events going on. The volatility is just screaming through the roof here. The JSA team has a price model they run after every report. We don't have the new crop parameters to work with. The goalposts on July corn futures, the upper end 475 and the lower end at 375. So that's something our team puts together to try to follow. Short term, full moon high here today. Maybe we'll pull back for a little while, but longer term, I think the corn market's well and alive.
Blood moon high, not just a full moon high. Oh, very nice. How about that?
You're up on me.
Matt Bent.
Yeah, there's a lot of things to talk about with the corn market. I mean, we talk acres after a while. You know, right now you've got big time demand. So when you look at the world, you know, when you look at the USDA's balance sheet, U.S. had the biggest crop ever last year, 17 billion bushel crop. The forecast is that Brazil will be bordering a record crop. Yet we actually drew down, according to the balance sheet from the USDA, stocks drew down about 5 million tons for this marketing year. That's what the forecast is, which is a notable thing, Todd, whenever we're producing like we are. And I agree with Brian. There's some question marks with that feed and residual usage category on the U.S. balance sheet. But I, you know, the thing is that if any of us could figure out exactly what the USDA does with the feed and residual usage category, I think that we could make ourselves some money because sometimes it doesn't always make sense. You look at where we're at a year ago. Last year was the first time in 50 years, you know, that you set a crop insurance average in February and then you didn't go back and revisit it. I mean, we haven't seen that happen. It's happened one time in my lifetime and it's been last year. So it made it a tough year to market. Whereas we actually started the month of March above the February average for December corn, which is at least we don't have that to worry about again. But I do think the market's offered us some opportunities here recently. But at the same time, I would echo, you know, what was said in the previous panel is that I do think there could be a significant amount of volatility this year because when you have massive demand like we have, the current forecast for demand on USDA's U.S. balance sheet is 16.47. You know, we've raised a crop bigger than that one time in our history. And so whenever you have massive demand, that necessitates that you have big production. If you run into a hiccup there, you know, then there's no question in my mind that volatility could enter this marketplace. So does that mean I'm sitting on my hands doing nothing? Absolutely not. I'm actually marketing some corn above 470 on Dece, and we can go into details on that later. But I still want to be pretty flexible if I get too overextended on my sales.
As a reminder, this edition of Commodity Week was recorded on the third day of March at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. Our panelists included Matt Bennett, whom you just heard, along with Mike Zuzulo, Brian Stark, and Kurt Kimmel. There was audience participation, as you'll hear.
I want to take up feed and residual, but I want to check something with you. How many of you have cattle, raise cattle, have cattle on the farm at the moment? Raise your hands up. Okay, that's kind of what I thought. All right, so I want to come back to the beef, but let's start with just feed and residual. Because I'm hearing that the residual might be a lot in that number as opposed to, you know, the feed usage. So what is the loss? You're in the elevator operation system. How much loss is there in that supply chain that kind of runs through the residual side?
I think Matt hit it on the head. If we knew the answer to that, we'd all be in a better spot. The residual piece, I think, is what creates the volatility we've all talked about, because it's really hard to measure. I think from stock report to stock report, we've seen the government struggle with the ability to really have a good handle on, you know, is the crop understated, overstated, and how that blends into true feed usage, especially when we've seen so many substitutes in the past 12 months up until we started to see relaxation of our disputes with China. You know, we didn't touch exporting Milo out of the Western Corn Belt. All right. That has impact to corn feed usage. And we saw where Milo couldn't be given away out in the West. You know, flip it to today, where now we're back exporting Milo. And so now you may see a scenario where the feed actually represents a bigger percentage than residual. But I don't know if there's a great answer for how you calculate the actual loss through that residual figure.
And then on the beef side, and we probably won't come back to this very much, but is the transition, and Mike, you might want to jump in on this given your proximity to the beef herd, but is the transition of the closing of plants in the United States, the opening of plants in Mexico, is that going to cause the beef herd in the United States to stay relatively small as it is now? It's at really small levels. I don't know. Either one of you could take that up.
Yeah, I'll just say physiologically, yes, it's going to take at least 2 years to get back to a sizable herd.
Well, that would just be normal cycle, how long it takes to build the herd.
But I mean, has the demand curve,
the demand for animals in the United States, been lessened enough that they actually will just be fed out Mexico? And does that really mean anything for the feed and residual number? Because it appears, and you've talked about this, that both the corn's being counted as an export and as a feed, both doubly somehow.
Yeah, I don't see it for two reasons, Todd. One, the weights are, you know, what, 900 plus 960,000,
right.
960 pounds dressed at this point. Some, you know, crazy number that we probably never thought we'd get to at this point. Number two, the ag attaché just put out a new livestock update for Mexico, and they're going to pump out 6% more beef exports. That screwworm has changed their livestock industry permanently. They are going to start retaining, they are going to start growing and finishing cattle instead of sending feeders across the border at this point. The attaché wrote it in no uncertain terms that pattern, that change is a permanent change undergoing. But they're sending most of those exports to the United States. So the beef consumption is not going down. The demand's not going down. We're just going to get it from other places.
That's Mike Zuzlo with GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. He made the trip from Atchison to the beef house in Covington, Indiana on the third day of March to join on stage Brian Stark of the Andersons out of Mansfield, Illinois, Kurt Kimmel from Normal, Illinois, and AgMarket.net's Matt Bennett from Windsor, Illinois. Commodity Week, of course, is taken from that program. You can hear it all right now if you'd like on willag.org, willag.org, and many of these stations will carry it over the weekend. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report on this Friday afternoon. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.